focus on what we're doing here. But this is a general overview. I wanted to talk, you know, the general purpose of NPS, just some statements about that. Wanted to talk about beam power, damage potential, and the time scales, because that's what sets the parameters for the machine protection system. I want to show some final configuration for PIP 2IT, because that's where we do all the testing. And we got a goal to achieve running beam up there in April of 2020. So there is some systems that need to be up and running, and it's going to be using that, because I don't see control system changing in block mouse. Philosophy regarding the protection scheme. Beam loss is very important. Fast loss, slow losses, low energy losses, and high energy losses. I want to distinguish the two differences and what the challenges are there. The machine, well, we get into it. The architecture and some DAQ requirements that we can consider here in this meeting, and what we need to have in the short term versus the long term. So the purpose, obviously, is to prevent and minimize instantaneous and long-term damage in the accelerator. And experimental instrumentation, we want to minimize false trips. We want to reduce downtime. It doesn't make sense if the NPS is off most of the time or down. And every time the machine goes off, I can tell you for a fact, you got to call for the NPS, that's the first thing that gets suspected. And so I've been living with that out at NML and other places. Response to failures from many systems. Response to hardware failures, operational failures, administrative ones, beam instabilities. The beam at high energy is very rigid. It's like a, you know, it's like a rigid wire. At low energy, where it's like a weak wire. It's a very, it's not rigid at all. And that's where all the problems come. That's what the challenges are really for a proton machine like PIP2. And the control system issues. So the NPS have to cope with a wide range of modes as well, different beam modes and all those things. So here's a general beam power damage potential from machines around the world. We are in the 1 megawatt and up range in PIP2, right? ESS is 5 megawatts, SNS is a megawatt pulse, FGRID is 400 kilowatts, depending on the species that you accelerate it. But we are right in here, hopefully even higher one day. The damage potential. So at PIP2 in 17, this was the maximum beam power that the machine was capable of delivering. So in 17, we limited the machine operation to pulse mode with 2.1 kilowatts. But even that can do damage. This is a hole being burnt. This is a scraper or some material being damaged. So even at that energy base, you know, sure this is sure that there is beam power, but it's valuing this damage because it tells us a time scale for drilling holes, right? It takes milliseconds to drill a hole, hundreds of milliseconds. So this lends to us designing a protection scheme that can protect the machine in microseconds on one hand, and on another hand, higher time scales for things that can't respond at the really, really fast scales.
Do you know if we're going to limit operations during that run to a mode that's compatible with what is the design baseline?
Yes.
So 550 microseconds at 20 hertz?
Yes, I'm going to show those parameters next.
I was going to ask a question. So those two failures, if I know this occurred while the NPS was kind of coming up to speed, but with the, I assume the answer is yes, but with proposed NPS system we're going to have out there, would it have caught these?
Oh yeah. We caught something very similar right after. The thing was we were impatient to run without certain software and stuff in place, and they ran. Nobody was here, and yeah, right. But the system, the ring pickups and stuff wasn't integrated properly yet, and you know, you had to get it. Fast protection, time scales of interest. So this fast protection system, right, this protects against prompt damage. This is immediate damage from the beam just hitting the machine itself, you know. And so we need a 10 microsecond response time for that, to 100 microseconds or so. There's a run permit system which operates at a millisecond time scale. This is all the inputs from PLCs and all this stuff, right? And it verifies the machine state and external conditions and gives you a real comprehensive overview of what the machine state is. And you can drive state devices and so on, right? PIP2, so we aim it for 10 microseconds in our design. The SNS, they're designed for 25 microseconds. They're now at 5 to 10 microseconds. And ESS is trying to get to 2 microseconds. You know more about this now than I do.
They're not there yet, that's for sure.
And FRIB is aiming for 10 microseconds.
Targ, are those two separate pieces of the MPS, fast protection and run permit, or
it depends
two
on how you segment things. I'm going to talk about that. However you configure or architect the MPS, you have these components that can be considered run permit only, right? Because they operate at that time scale that they only take secondary information. And the MPS is critical to the MPS, but it's not the primary driver for fast losses, for example. So here's the final configuration for PIP2IT, as far as your question. Right. The maximum expected beam parameters. The iron source can provide up to 15 milliamps up to CW. The Leavitt can provide up to 10 milliamps up to CW to 550.55 milliseconds. Right, 20 hertz. The RF cube, up to CW RF, 10 milliamps, 0.5, 5 times 20 hertz. The MEBIT, 10 milliamps to 2 milliamps with the same parameters. And the HWR, CW RF only, SSR1, CW on a millisecond. Right, this is what I'm told. And then HWR, SSR1, and HEBIT.
What's the millisecond?
This is, I think they want to, obviously this guy can't do. This number comes for the provision to actually run pulses in SSR1.
Okay, I don't understand CW in 1 millisecond. Is that beam? CW beam?
Or is that RF?
RF?
CW RF and 1 millisecond.
Of beam.
Of RF.
There is no
beam. Sorry. Beam. 20 hertz. Sorry. Beam. This is beam parameters.
CW RF. But why would there be a millisecond? Okay. I don't understand.
These numbers came from. These numbers are numbers I got from Sasha.
Okay.
Regarding this stuff. So we can discuss the details of why 1 millisecond, why they would want to run a pulse there.
But I mean, there's everything else is 0.55 milliseconds. So how do you get to 1 millisecond in the middle of the machine? It makes no sense.
Probably 0.55. That's in reality.
I think it's 1 millisecond, but I didn't ask Lionel about this. And I didn't. I'm just showing you parameters that I was.
Sure. Yeah, I just want to push to make it. So these make sense because cannot go back into running 30 different modes in this machine again.
Right.
We do not have the time to do that.
Sure.
Right.
No, I understand. I just requested the parameters, and these are the parameters I got yesterday, and I'm showing them here today.
Okay, great.
Okay. Now
but
I don't
have
know.
Somebody else, you get a different set.
If everybody you go to, you get a different set, right?
Yeah.
Well, I know for sure that some of them will be true, and some of them will be. Argued over.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a working group. So
okay, we should get Edward.
We should get Edward or somebody.
Somebody
right?
Nail this down.
Okay,
otherwise it's gonna be all over the place.
Let's see. Okay, so the. Sorry, guys. Make sure I didn't skip a slide. So the general philosophy regarding the MPS, right? The MPS requires tight monitoring of the beam current and losses in the Leavitt. And in MEBIT, that's the warm front end. The reason we want to do it there, make these measurements, this is where you have the lowest beam power density, there's negligible residual radiation, there's lower sensitivity in the warm to the warm of the warm elements to beam loss there, and there's lower replacement cost. So be tricky, low energy part, the warm front end as the source of the machine. And because you can do less damage there, and there's no big equipment to fail, right? Well, not big enough to be a concern. So this decreases the potential for critical beam-induced damage. So the warrant from head is treated as a source in a general sense. All right, so the upcoming slides describes this. Right, see the upcoming slides, the machine layout, critical instrumentation, and issues.
So this is all in reference to PIP 2?
This is in reference to the front end.
Front end, but I mean?
IT.
Okay.
But I assume that's the front end that will be used.
Well, slight modifications maybe to it.
Yeah, but the modifications aren't going to change this philosophy.
No, but as you're going through the slides, you can point out when there's a difference between PIP 2 IT and PIP 2.
Right. So current monitors. So we know we've got to measure current, we've got to measure losses, and current monitoring is a big deal there, right? So this is the beamline layout. So the DCCT in the Levitt will not be part of the NPS. The ACCT in the Levitt and the ACCT in the Mevitt, the first one, will be used to control losses in the RFQ. This is these two guys here. The ACCT, the second one in the Mevitt, and the ACCT in the Hebit will be used to control losses in the SRF. That's these guys right here. And the ACCT in the Hebit, and the dump will be used to control losses in the Hebit.
Okay, so as Aisha walked in, note the first four lines, because that's, as you walked in, that's your, just note that, that's what's.
Right. So the DCCT in the Mevitt is going to be used to control the average current, average over 15 milliseconds, that goes into the SRF.
Are you going to feed that into the machine protection and the
all Mevitt these, DCCT? All the ACCTs, the DCCTs, and the RPUs are going to be NPS dedicated devices. I get to that. And they're also what we call primary devices.
What do you mean by dedicated?
Let me go on. They're primary devices that are required in order to inhibit and stop a major beam-related issue in the machine. And those are the only way we can measure current losses. Because at low energy, as you know, there's no... So I think I covered it all, right? So, but these are the locations of these devices. It's 2 MeV in this region, 10 MeV here, and 22 MeV by the time you get over here. The ring pickups, all for the NPS. The comparison of currents between RPU1 versus RPU2 and 3 and 4 are used to do various tasks in the machine, right? Because we're going to be removing bunches using the absorber. So RPU1 shall be used also to prevent injection into a Mevitt. This is this guy here for protect the Mevitt. And RPU3 is used standalone for the case where we're doing conditioning of the absorber. So we can monitor current there.
Sasha, sorry about that. With the ring pickups 3 and 4, did you ever get them to work with the chopper one? Or was that the problem?
We got all of them to work.
Even with the chopper chopping?
Yes.
The ring pick, okay.
Yes.
I thought
as a matter of fact, one of them was monitoring the chopper, by comparing the pulse coming out of the chopper with the pulse measured with the beam. If it was more than a microsecond difference, you know, the chopper had a problem.
I thought Sasha said they didn't get those to work.
Well, we didn't get them to be a system that we could depend on day to day, but we did get them to work. So the insertion devices. So in the Hebit, we have slits and wire scanners. We got an insertable Faraday cuff. We got a fast Faraday cuff. We got Mevitt scrapers. We got 16 of those, and we got an Allison scanner. I put these down so that we can have numbers of how many devices, how many channels and stuff we want. So I try in this talk to outline how many pieces of hardware we have to deal with.
So note, the scrapers are not going to be instrumented. I was told that's not necessary.
The scrapers are not going to be instrumented.
Like the Mevitt scrapers are, those are the Mevitt scrapers. I thought the Hebit you're talking about. Never mind.
Okay.
I misread that.
Sorry.
I thought those were Hebit scrapers you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. China's reporting excessive current loss, so to be controlled in operational mode. So to control operational modes, we need to monitor the losses on Mebit scrapers, the kicker protection electrodes, and the differential pump condenser. This has already been tested. I'm gonna talk about this a little bit, and we, you know, the system works, and we think we got a good handle on that. Greg here worked with us on getting that to go on the needle and numbers. Jumping ahead of myself though. So let's talk a little bit about beam loss. So prompt beam loss, it needs fast response on the microsecond time scale. And the sources for these losses are from the chopper malfunction, as opposed to when choppers operate normally, you always get steady state losses from the chopper. Fast current losses from invasive devices, you know, scrapers, devices you put into the machine, beam dynamics issues from puncture adjustments and so on can cause losses. Missteering, of course, and also depositing the full beam energy locally. So we need to have fast loss measurements there. There's also slow beam loss that leads to radiative activation of the system, cryogenic heating, and so on. This is a longer term effect, but it's real. And then the sources for that is obviously beam scattering and slow loss from the beam itself. The rule of thumb is that 1 watt per meter losses generates about 100 millirem per hour. SNS which has about 30 to 40 millirem per hour at 100 megawatts.
One megawatt.
That would be nice. Yeah, at a megawatt. So beam losses are critical. So beam loss detection, I separate it into two categories. High energy loss, that produces gammas and neutrons with very strong energy dependence. And that's where detection methods are ionization chambers, sodium iodide detectors, semiconductor devices, standard loss monitor. But that's a high energy loss.
We're probably also fast neutron detectors in there. Maybe you consider it under sodium iodide,
Right, so the fast responses is nanoseconds to microseconds, depending on the detector you use. Low energy loss. Now this is in red because this is inherently difficult to measure and detect. They do not escape the beam pipe and can cause fringes. We see this as an interesting challenge, right, for injecting from the front end. I don't think the biggest NPS problem is going to be whether or not we can get beam through the cryo modules. Can we get it in to the cryo modules without fringing? This is really a big problem, and every time a committee has come here, they've asked this question, and the answer has always been soft. It requires special loss monitoring techniques and diagnostics, and we need to do some testing a bit too. This is the reason for the diamond detector, which I'll say something about here. So the MPS architecture. So from a perspective view, the system has three functional layers. And this is how you decide to segment the system. It's a common structure in most protection schemes, even ESS. Every machine has these layers. So there's a machine interface layer. This processes machine data from relevant subsystems. It could be okay, not okay from subsystems. Various algorithms that run directly in the MPS or in that system, and it carries different signal types. There's a main logic layer, which is a run permit segment, and is a fast protection segment as well. And then there's a beam inhibit layer, which is basically the machine beam inhibit devices designed to function at various priority levels. So you got four devices that we'll use in PIP2 as inhibit devices, and they have a priority in how we fire them. But this shaded or this one. Here, this is the three layers, and this is the area that we're talking about, right? The DAQ. How do we combine a fast DAQ to accomplish some of these tasks? So, this is direct interest to this meeting. This is just a general block diagram showing that you got all these inputs, you got these three layers as I described, and you got these signals and the protection inhibit devices. the Leavitt chopper, the iron source, the Leavitt dipole, and the iron source wire supply. These are things that can actually stop beam from producing beam, or limiting beam, or diverting beam.
One time in the past, we used to have the RFQ on that list.
We're trying to protect the RFQ now from damage. But yeah, the RFQ can stop us being at the 2.1 MeV level from getting injected into the next stage, yes.
You want to make the RF to the RFQ like a safety device and turn it off?
Well, yeah, I'll talk about my idea later, but yeah. Basically, if the RFQ is pulse, you're guaranteed to not have beam outside of that time window with a pretty hard constraint.
If you inhibit the RFQ in some way, how much time does it take to re-inhibit it?
If it's pulse, not very long.
Not very long. If it's not pulse.
But I'm saying even just as an operational mode, just run it pulsed. And you could monitor that it's actually running pulsed, and then you've got 99% the time guaranteed you're not getting that beam downstream of that. Just something to think about.
Okay, I'm going to skip through some of these fast because the time goes quick by sitting up here. But anyhow, the NPS, we've seen this before. The NPS out to right now uses a general purpose. FPGA board. All the digitization and everything is done outside of that. And what this board does, it has a couple of FPGAs that allow you to swap code in and out. It has a lot of user available channels for inputs and outputs. It has a lot of I/O programmable. You can program this type of thing into to do a lot of different tasks. We use this in Sequest, the Zhou Yang experiment as a trigger system and so on. But we got a newer board and it works well. It's the heart of the NPS at IOTA. It also handles the timing and so on for IOTA. Again, the digitization and all that stuff is done outside of this board. What I want to talk about today is a scheme for getting fast data, which we've been talking about here, to the NPS. And the proposal is that you have some sensor device, you have some signal condition, you've got some processing, digitizers, all this stuff. This box is a fast data queue. And we would like to have this box be the system that sends signals to the NPS on certain devices, and also maybe share data. Either raw data or condition data to other machine elements, other machine purposes. The line has to be drawn somewhere, and for certain devices, the devices that are relevant to machine protection, or to operate the machine, we would want an architecture like this. Outside of that, you can have all the different architectures we've been talking about in principle. This is arguable too. I mean, this is just an idea. All right. This system then could, this field instrument could be any of our devices. It could be the ring pickups, primary devices. Right now these things are, I wouldn't imagine re-architecting WhatsApp PIC2 IT right now because that's in VME crates and you know they got a system there that's been moved to support what we're doing now. But a fast DAQ then could handle various number of devices, including ACCTs and DCCTs for doing this difference. Comparison. So one proposal is that we do something like that. Some NPS DAQ requirements. This is just some stuff. This is not a full list of requirements, but we would want, you know, the ability to. This is just off the top of my head some reasonable requests for parameters. Actually, some of them fit very nicely within a board that Philip described. A board that. Guys in computing division describe, and also a board that you sent some level.
Right. Ed had talked about
Ed.
Yeah.
Yes. So, but you know, distributed instrumentation, and diagnostics need this, right? So the ability to use process FPGA data from all parts of the accelerator complex is what's required. Require hardware interfaces to digitize in hardware electronics. One high-speed DAC, 16 bits is fine, 125 mega samples, 8 to 16 channels, based on the count of hardware that's available to protect the warm front end. That's a reasonable number. We want high-speed DACs, I.O.
It means 15 nanoseconds, if you're talking about 125.
I.O. delay, yeah.
So why you define this delay like 15 nanoseconds?
Yeah, I put that on there because the present board that we have has that as a parameter. We know that work. So I would not go for something that's worse.
That's pretty fair.
But it exists.
Yeah, you need to define what an IO delay is.
We have to draw an example. With the example that you're thinking of right there.
Yeah,
I think there's a specific example you have in mind.
So let's get back to that so I don't get
There's
a specific.
I would have worked at that,
yeah. Yeah, so we'll remember to put an asterisk next to that one and we'll search that one out a little more later.
Anyhow, so input triggers and stuff like that, right? So we need high bandwidth, backbone of some sort. I don't know, high speed transmitter. We talked about fiber, MTP, MPO in this meeting, right? And then these are, you know, you want sub-microsecond resolution. You want timestamping, synchronization. Gigabit. Of communications. And then these are just some parameters that we have to talk about in general. Some of these obviously depend on the control system environment here. I don't know, currently we're using ACNET, PIP2 IT. I suspect when we start up next year, we still will be. But ethics is planned for the future, and this is a topic for Jim's.
Jim, I asked him a question about whether to do any ethics at all, PIP2 IT. He said, absolutely not. So, although I paraphrase a little bit, but the idea is this is not enough time to do anything out there, and it would be a distraction, he said, so it's going to be ACNET out there. Art, can you go back a second? I want to see if I understand this. So your top set, you have distributed instrumentation and diagnostic. You're just throwing things out there, because I looked at you had high-speed DACs. What we use the DACs for? This would be...
Right.
So you want analog signals going out to control.
Right. So for example, there's some devices that we control, and we want to send them information as well. Example... the chopper. We communicate with Greg's chopper. We send information out. In this case, it's a signal frequency to get Greg a permit.
I see.
And
okay.
We also read information back and forth. So this is an example. Probably not the perfect example, but why wouldn't you have something?
I wasn't thinking that way. I was thinking too much.
I'm brainstorming here a little bit.
Yeah.
Right?
These aren't set in stone.
No.
Like 16-bit.
No.
No,
they're not. They're not.
16 is pretty pricey.
Yeah. Okay, I'm putting down some. We can knock things down to realistic numbers, but.
Well, it could be more than one board.
All right.
What would it. We have to match it to the requirements of what we need to measure for what purposes.
Depends on which instrument you're trying to.
You don't want to get stuck in the case where everybody buying, top of the line up.
Sure. So I'm just setting down some parameters that we can, or somebody can decide that, hey, MPS doesn't need that. This is what we need. Somebody else needs something else to compromise on the, on what boards we buy. But if you don't put anything down, nobody complains. good complaining.
Yeah. We'll iterate on this. I mean, this is just a start. And we'll have to iterate on the details to know where to draw the lines, where to put the functions, either on this side of the link or the other side of the link. And then you're going to talk about primary. This is the good part, I think. It's because there's going to be a handful of things that are the most important.
Yeah.
And we'll have to make sure, if it's not a big handful of things, they could be treated separately without impacting all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets to be quite a few things, then we probably have to build something special into the majority of the stuff.
So, So this is what we see as the primary devices. So primary devices must function to operate the accelerator. They protect the prime infrastructure and the entire machine from direct beam induced damage, RFQs, cryo modules, extensive big stuff. Right? They're the first and most critical line of defense and are locked and calibrated for MPS use. They should guarantee that when they function properly, no dramatic damage can be caused by the beam. It should not be mass, for normal operation. In other words, you can't turn the machine on if these devices aren't up or functioning, because they're critical to.
They can't be bypassed.
They can't be bypassed. That's the main thing.
Yeah, this actually was brought up. I brought this up a little bit when I was at ESS, and they point out that that's philosophically a good idea, but then you're subject to single point failures for something. So, for example, at the moment we have an ACC for PIP2, forget PIP2 IT, PIP2 ACC at the front, an amendment right before the problem, ACC at the end. The problem is, one of the ACC team goes down, or at least the last one goes down, you're now stuck, whereas if you have distributed ACCDs, and also for commissioning, it makes you have a little bit of redundancy.
I saw a list of 4 or 5 versus this versus that in the previous slide.
Yeah.
I mean, all those ACCTs versus other ACCTs, there was 4 or 5, comparisons, and they're all primary, aren't they?
Yes, they're all primary, but they're all looking at different sections of the machine, if you look at that.
Right, so that raises your false positive
primary
rates
for
when you do that. So that's it. We'll have to trade that off and figure out how you want to do it.
Reliability is an issue. If not, you have to do redundancy, because you have to measure the transmission loss through the machine.
No, I understand that. I'm just pointing out that having more, where now I think Sasha was pushing for less, I'm trying to push Edward to have more because of issues. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that one line there? We said they are first and most critical line of defense and are locked and calibrated for MPS use.
Right, so they have to be calibrated for MPS purposes only. They can't be using them for beam studies, in other words, the changing calibrations.
But you will be. I mean, they're not going to put double ACCTs in, right?
Well,
so they'll have to.
See, the calibrations aren't going to change.
Yeah, calibrations will
change. I'm not saying you can't take data from them. I'm saying you can't reconfigure the, for some special need projects.
Yeah.
You can't move the game at this stage to part of the.
So that may be okay, but it may be. So I'll just say that I brought this issue up when I was at ESS. I said, how are they going to handle this? How are they going to split the signals and stuff? And so what they're going to do, because it's the least expensive, although it's not perfect, is they're going to get their FPGA boards to have large FPGAs, and they're going to lock the FPGA code down for the MPS portion, and anything in diagnostic will be not locked down. And that's not 100% foolproof, but that's how they're going to go off and do it. So the MPS functionality and work of that nature will be locked. So we may consider that here. That's why I'm asking what you mean by locked and calibrated for MPS. So. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be. It has
to be stable.
It has to be stable, yeah.
Secondary devices. So these devices protect locally. If they malfunction, they will not create dramatic damage, either because they're, their damage can be mitigated by primary devices already, or they're protecting local equipment or themselves, right? They also decrease the probability of damage and irradiation components. So these are the secondary devices. These are the masks are the protection electrodes that are used to protect the kickers, the 200 ohm kickers, and 50 ohm kickers, I guess. Scrapers and ring pickups.
Hookups. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. They're next to each other.
At least I didn't put a half. So.
Yeah.
But anyhow, you get the idea. So there's a scheme already we tested with the mass for the protection electrodes. That was a good test. I don't want to go through the whole thing, but essentially we had a scheme where we there's some protection mass here that can take the hit from the beam as it gets injected, and the current measured off of those devices is integrated. And essentially, the integral is set up in such a way that you can sustain a small current hitting these things for a long time, or a large current for a very short time before you trip, or 5 microamps, I think, is that right, for continuously. So that, without going into all the details, that was tested. I'll skip this one. This is just some details of that. It was measured down to 6 microamps successfully, and it never tripped at 5 microamps, so it worked. The noise was not a problem, as far as I know. Is that correct, Rick?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and so it worked. So we applied this algorithm, this scheme, to the other devices, like scrapers. Last run, we achieved the ability to move all those scrapers into a separate crate to install this algorithm. We never got a chance to test it, but I have no reason to believe it wouldn't work. There may be some modifications we have to do, but it's possible.
It does depend on a good zero.
Yes, it depends on a good zero, and that is part I skipped there about zeroing the device, but I don't want to get it too far in the weeds here.
That's what scared me about your proposal with pulsing the RFQ. Is what? Well, you're talking about the baseline, and we noticed when we pulse the RFQ out there, baselines bounce all over the place. So that's something we'll have to look into some more.
Configuration and beam inhibit devices. So there's several devices that we have to use to do machine configuration control. And of course the valves, the 8 slow valves and 1 fast valve is there. The Leavitt scrapers, right, to close the RFQ entrance for Leavitt tuning, for example. And then there's beam inhibiting devices. These are the 4 beam inhibiting devices I talk about. The ion source high voltage, the ion source modulator, the Leavitt bend, and the Leavitt chopper, located as you see here, and these are the associated valves. So those are going to be very important for configuration control. We got a whole set of slides we're not going to go through on the configuration control mechanism, and that was based on operational experience with the machine and how you would configure it for different modes and so on.
Which is the fastest of those 4?
The chopper.
The chopper.
The chopper can shut off beam in less than half a microsecond. 500, is that right, Greg?
Yeah, that's right, man.
I'll skip this. This is a table. I started to generate a table with all of the devices. How many channels, inputs, and everything. And I got stuck because there was conflicting information. From every time I talked to someone, I got different numbers. And I think the ones I am sure about, I wrote in. The other ones, I put question marks. So we need to complete this table so that we have a... So other people have to sit down and give me a full inventory.
This is a table for PIP2 you're doing?
This is PIP2 IT, yes.
At the moment, but you do the same thing for PIP2.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And then the other devices, I want to skip through that. I'll skip this as well. It's a similar table, but I'm putting in some requirements so that we have everything in one place. It took a while to try to get all the information together, and I'm trying to gather. So operational modes and configuration control. So each mode has been defined, and we are reviewing operational scenarios and flow charts for this, right? So we're in the process of doing this. But we define these modes: operational mode, diagnostic mode, beam enabled mode, control access ready mode, and a machine off mode. And I got tons of slides about how each mode is defined, what devices are involved, what readbacks, what instrumentation is needed. And there's also a flow diagram for this. We need to transition from one mode to the other smoothly, without shutting off completely and so on. Right?
Yeah. I was wondering about the definitions of primary and secondary devices in each of these modes. I mean, maybe
yes, that's in the, that's
so
in
each
that.
Of these modes has its own set of primary and secondary. That's not necessarily so. Primary may not be primary for all the modes.
Well,
I mean, not because, of course, if you're just testing part of the accelerator, can you test, once all this stuff's strung together, can you just test so far down?
Yes.
So the certain things will be masked off. Like if you're comparing end to end, that'll be masked off. You'll just be looking at...
So what we described, and I didn't bring it here because it's number 20 slides, is each mode we went through how we would configure it. and what would be critical components, primary, secondary devices in each mode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we can sit down and talk about that. But I thought it would be too detailed for here because
publication?
It will be next week. But we thought we would pass this by the two people first before we made it too public, because
in a PDR. You said next week. Where's it going to be next week?
Well, next week we generated this information in the last couple of weeks. And design these modes so we can talk to controls people about how we would implement this.
Right.
And we decided, let's go through it among ourselves, people who operate the machine and has operation experience. And then we wanted to take this to Elvin and Edward and Fernando. And
we should probably go, instrumentation should be involved too, so we make sure that we're compatible with everything we're coming up with.
Sure,
yeah.
Whoever
yeah.
wants to be involved. But we I have the slides and hot off the press, but I didn't show them here. I just mentioned that we're defining some modes because people need to tell us what they want. And they need to tell us soon because we have to work on this.
Physics machine people need to tell you.
Yeah.
Well, but they have to be controlled, because what ended up happening at 2IT is the data's used, they thought they had a dial and they could dial anything they wanted to. And they thought all the instruments and everything would react as if everything, the calibration constants worked everywhere. And they don't, right? So that's one of my inputs, I'd say, is we'd want to restrict the number of modes so we didn't have some kind of infinite number where people can just change whether they want.
Well, it could be,
because it screws
it
us all
be,
up.
It should be iterative. We should get our chance at day
and court. We got a fixed number of modes that we think could be fixed.
Yeah.
And they're based on actual operational scenarios in the machine. For example, turning the machine off is a mode, right? What do you turn off? What stays on? What can you do when the machine is in that state, right? But these are all reasonable modes, and these are things that we do every time we run the machine, so they have to be modes. If not, you're randomly just doing them. Again, you're
yeah,
correct.
I agree.
You can restrict the number of modes, but you have to be able to control how modes are set up.
I guess my point is more under each mode, like diagnostic or operation mode, you don't have a half a dozen different operating points. So if on your operational mode, you don't have where you can run the beam and all these different currents and pulse lengths. That's where you get screwed up. That's where you get screwed up at least. So, that's not mode. That's like under that mode, what are the operational set points? And that's
sure.
where I think we would.
We have that. We can look at it. And we got two beam modes, essentially, beam modes. You got short pulses, 10 microseconds.
Yeah.
And then you got everything else. Right. And what you're talking about, what is the end, everything else in compass?
Yeah, and also they're talking about not just pulse length, but currents. Now they want to be able to go 0.2 milliamps to 2 milliamps, and so we need to, because every time you change something, it changes calibrations.
Yeah.
And I'll screw the MPS every time.
Well,
the modes will inform the specifications for the instrumentation.
But they can't just be.
And then we'll have to feed. We'll have to feedback on those specifications. What we can and can't do.
Gonna have to get rid of all the physicists. They're gonna want to do every mode.
Well, that's what happened at PIP2IT. Sasha would always change random pulse lengths, and things would break. And then he got mad. If things doesn't work. Well, calibrations especially, because we hide a lot of things in a calibration of a given operating point. Given operating point, we don't fix all the systematics. We calibrate them out. You change that operating point, then.
As long as there's a general expectation that instrumentation needs to feedback what they really can do, and to inform the specification. As long as everybody understands that's
the
step of the process, we'll be okay.
Write a sequencer that does.
Yeah, you guys write
right.
sequencers
that's
for
what
that
you have
machine
to do
out there, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Well, actually, we decided we're not going to use the sequencer for setting up mode because you can do that from anywhere. We're going to have a configuration table, an equivalent that's hidden.
Yeah.
A hidden configuration table. At NML, you have a configuration table that allows you to configure modes at the register level, and then you lock them down, and then you can't from the sequencer undo that. So what is needed in the near term? I was thinking of a development test case for PIP2IT. We talked about this before with the DAQ. But let's talk about what instruments. So we got DCCTs and ACCTs out there. We want to do a comparison, between two devices. We want to process the signal using an integral that looks like this to calculate the threshold, right? And
but why are you going to weight it that way? That's the integral you guys are using for the scrapers, right? We can talk about this.
No, this is, we can talk about that, but that's not the same integral.
Oh, okay. I can't really see from it. I thought it was. My eyes aren't so good.
Yeah, that's a Z, not a tilde. I don't know what it is.
Here's an example from SNS, from Steve. They do it, obviously. They got a wideband CT, gigahertz, 1 microsecond droop time. They've implemented a system. This is the waveform that they get. I'm going a little quicker here because time is getting short. They've achieved 8.5 microsecond abort time using this. And they think they can get it down to 6 microseconds. That's within the time scales that we're interested in here. All right. They've listed here all the time scales that added up to give that number. You know, in the LINAC, you know, 2 microseconds for time of flight. The rise time of the ACCT is is that 1.2 or 1.2?
1.2.
And then there's the cable length adds another 0.1 microseconds. The ADC's throughput, 4 microseconds to process, and a nanosecond for the optical transmission. And you know, so they measure this thing thoroughly, and they got numbers.
Well, that's a good example of what the thought process looks like.
Yeah.
But this will be a case where if the beam gets too small, this measurement won't work, right?
Well, there's bandwidth limitations, right? So the ACCTs, what do you think about them? Megahertz?
I don't know about a bandwidth. I mean, it's just signal height.
Intensity. Yeah, we're all
concerned about that.
Intensity
gets so small, you may not be able to rely on your primary thing in such and such a mode. I mean, we have to work through that. I think that's something
small,
we have to look at here.
Is it small, that it's below the damage potential of the machine?
If it gets below the damage potential of the machine, hopefully we can measure things.
So this probably
won't work. The damage potential of the machine.
This probably won't work for slow losses. It'll work for the acute losses. ESS has the same issue. So their idea is that you know, it'll work when you have like a 50% beam loss or you know tens of percent, but it's not going to work at the like half percent beam loss because of noise issues.
Well, they claim here 1% of full beam current.
Yeah, so maybe we could probably get 1% of the work, but I think we could do maybe 1%, a couple of percent.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Just because of
1% is very, very, very rarely spec. Wants us to be, actually, isn't it? 1% of...
It depends on the time scale, right?
At worst case scenario, 1% loss is the only damage potential to drill holes in the machine. That's the point.
But 4 microamps is less than 1%. Beam current.
Pardon?
Isn't, I mean, what is full beam current here?
So that's SNS.
This is F RIP. I don't know.
I just took a slide. Oh, okay.
F RIP runs really small currents.
I just took a slide, so I don't know.
So what is, are you still looking at the 2 milliamps?
2 milliamps. So it'll be 20 microamps.
20 microamps. That's tough.
Yeah.
The noise level was about that.
Yeah, I know it's tough.
I don't think we had better than 100 microamps. The noise was about 100 microamps. So
we need to present the calculations and show what we can do. And then when we give it to them, they'll ask us what they want us to do, and then we'll say, well, we've already figured out. Here's a piece of paper. You can take it and read it and punch the numbers on the calculator, and you'll come to the same conclusion that we can't do anything.
Did you present this that case before to the meeting about the resolution of this measurement?
We might have shown some stuff for like the transmission to the RFQ comparison, but I don't remember anything other than that.
Yeah.
We should do it.
I know the request is shouted.
Yeah, once we have to go to the work to get the same knowledge in everybody's head.
The bad thing about it, I think, even numbers.
To give the numbers that we got, they averaged it over like 32 pulses, 16 pulses. So it was like over a long time scale, and that's far longer than this 10 microseconds here.
We're being dominated by noise systematics out there that at least have typical IT.
You got baselines bumping up and down, that adds to
when
your...
When the RFQ is shopping, they're even worse.
That's
because base times do...
You've got those bumping up and down, that reduces your resolution.
Yeah.
And it's when you get the spec, you know, it's like, okay, if the baseline's bumping up and down, and there's nothing we can do about that, somebody else has to do something about it.
Yeah.
If they're going to... Anyway, those are fun things for the future.
But when we write the specification or when we write our report for this thing, we should mention that that's a challenge, right? And why it is a challenge.
We need to iterate back and forth. When you write yours, we should review it. And when we, you know, do our iteration, you guys review that.
Yeah.
Because we have to work together. And it'll be all right.
So I just wanted to talk now. That was talking about one type of loss, transmission loss, and then there's the low energy loss, which I think is a bigger challenge.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I have enough time, but. The idea here, though, is that we use a diamond detector as a loss monitor. I've achieved diamond detectors now that are 20 microns, which are really, really thin, and can measure losses at 2.1 MeV inside the vacuum chamber. The ones I tested with were, I'll skip through the physics, but essentially diamonds are very useful because they can run at, in room temperatures, they run at cryogenic temperatures, they're very, very fast. They are, they got a lot of linearity from 1 MIP to 10 to 9 MIPs, right? Minimizing particles. There's plenty of signal coming from these things, even at low energies. And we needed a thin diamond so that the beam doesn't stop in the detector, but can transition the detector. So the thinner you vent, the better. We use a single crystal.
You'll strip, so the H minus will become protons, but.
Not in a single crystal thin diamond.
Well, the electrons won't make it through. I'm pretty sure they won't.
I'll show you the Bragg peak for protons.
Right.
We got a proton machine. I'll show you the Bragg peak for protons, and we are below the Bragg peak, and I'll show you the charge yield, which is what we're interested in. This is we are at this energy here. And you get you need 13 eV for electron hole pair. We get 1.6 fender coulombs per minute. And we are somewhere on this region, we get up to 10 fender coulombs. We tested a diamond out there. It's got RF shielding, so it doesn't pick up the RF noise. We get a decent signal. This was 150 microns, as you remember, it was a test case. It was not thin enough to, so the beam stopped in it. So we had to keep cycling the bias voltage to keep it going. The newer diamonds are thin. They're 20 microns, right? We would have needed at the same higher thicknesses, a higher energy beam, but we have 2.1 MeV. So this worked out great. So sorry if I'm skipping through a lot of this details about the diamond, but the point is that they can measure the loss that we need. Here's a measurement with the thicker diamond. This is the beam on here. This is the signal from the diamond. And this is it zoomed in, where you can see an individual single particle loss in the diamond. This one is showing two protons, and this is showing one proton getting lost in the diamond. The plan is to use these diamonds in 1D scraper, housing out there. We have two now, we're getting two more. And this will give us a good loss monitor at low energy. Here's the Bragg peak for the diamond, and we are down here now.
So it's really a halo measurement, right?
It depends on how you use the diamond. You can use it as a loss monitor to just measure secondary losses or primary loss even. Or you can put it into the beam and measure beam halo particles. Depending on how you design the detector.
You keep them out or keep them.
But I think we use it primarily as a loss monitor because we need to know that, the level of loss that we can tolerate and how to tune the beam to get through the parameters. This is an image of what the diamond looks like that we have right now. This is the substrate, this is the diamond detector. It's one connection that sends in high voltage and brings up the signal. The thinner the diamond, the better, because the voltage, the bias voltage goes as the thickness. So for 20 microns, you just need 20 volts. For 150 microns, you need 150 volts bias. Here's some data. Several years ago, I went to CERN when we were testing diamonds, and this is a polycrystal, but this is a standard loss monitor in the ejection chamber. And here's a diamond detector showing the losses. But you can see if you zoom in from on one of these, you can see the individual particles. This is probably time to zoom in the bunches. And you zoom in further, you can actually see a single bunch in the LSC. So the diamonds are proven to work. They're very robust and they're fast. We need to know how to use them though in a machine protection scheme. I don't know.
I think right now for crypto IT, you want to make measurements and see what's coming up.
Yeah. And we want to put in the other loss monitors as well, because we're seeing gammas up there already.
Yeah, just to tell you, we're trying to get this one that SecClay makes. It's a neutron detector, fast, and it's really good at knocking out thermal neutrons. So we're going to try to see if we can get one here to test. And if we like them, we'll buy them for good too, and part of, or some little part of the MPS. Because you didn't go into BLM inputs for the MPS, but I'm assuming you'll have them at some level.
Yeah, at higher energy beyond 22 MeV, you can use standard loss monitoring techniques.
Right.
And those are very, very useful. But the beam is nice and rigid.
Yeah, so
these are